Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Mosaics. Today, we're in Halifax, Nova Scotia, at the home of Ms. Shari Vogler. She lives here in Halifax with her husband, Bob, and she has been a very important member of this community, both in the United States and Canada, for a very long time. Shari was the cook extraordinaire of the Vidyadhara, and that title was the Machin Wangmo. And she was also instrumental in building, serving, and basically being up day and night in the creation of Trungpa Rinpoche's court. And later on, she served as the director of the Shambhala Center here in Halifax, serving Sakyong Lipan Rinpoche. Welcome, Shari.
Thank you.
Shari, can you tell me when you met Trungpa Rinpoche and how that happened?
Met Trungpa Rinpoche at Karma Choling in 1975 in July, when he came to teach the four dharmas of Gampopa at Karma Choling. I thought I was in transition at that point between university and medical school, that I was going to go to Korea in the Peace Corps as a paramedic, but my life took a different turn after meeting him.
So you were in transition to go to medical school because you had been, I remember, in New College in Florida. So you
That's
were just great pre-med students and off you go to meet Trungpa Rinpoche. But why were you there to begin with?
So my best friend from university, Polly Van Dinten Foss, she was studying history and had taken some courses in Eastern religions and was quite interested. And we were up at her family home in Derby, Vermont, which is on the Vermont-Canadian border. Coming, and we decided to visit Karma Choling one day. And
Tail of the Tiger at the time.
Tail of the Tiger, right. That she, we both sort of knew about from, I had read, by then I had read Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism by Trungpa Rinpoche. And so we thought we would just hitchhike down and visit, and we did. And we were shown around Karma Choling by John Barbieri. And that was wonderful. We went back to Derby, and then we were hitchhiking down to Connecticut to my parents' house. And we were stopped by a policeman at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon on the highway. And he very politely told us that we could not hitchhike on the highway itself, but we could at the bottom of the ramp. And it was getting dark down there at the bottom of the ramp, and a white Saab drove by, stopped on the highway, and backed down the ramp. And it was John Barbieri. And he happened to be going to Connecticut to visit his parents. So he drove us down and told us about this seminar, told us more about Trungpa Rinpoche and this seminar called Four Dharmas of Gampopa. And so I went up, stayed in a tent, and went to that. And then I decided that since I had a few months before Korea, that I would just stay at Karma Choling and learn meditation. And I did that. And in September, Trungpa Rinpoche came back to teach. And Connie Berman asked if I would be the housekeeper at BPB, which was Trungpa Rinpoche's home when he taught at Karma Choling. And she taught me very meticulously to remove every fly spot from the walls and every spider web and every bit of dust. Every dust mote, yes. It was very...
white glove treatment.
She was very, yeah. It was wonderful training. And then we were having breakfast sometime during that visit at Karma Choling, and Connie looked up at me and said, well, I don't know about you going to Korea. I'm going to get you an interview with Trungpa Rinpoche. So she did. And I went over, and he sat in the sunlight in his living room there at BPB. And I sat across from him and explained how I thought this could all work, that I could go to Korea and correspond with my meditation instructor. And I had this whole thing that I thought that, you know, constructed. And he just sat there, and there was a gap, and he had his chin in his hand, and he just softly looked at me and said, "Well, I think you should stay. Of course, it's only my opinion." And I, at that point, it was like everything became crystal clear. I don't know if you've experienced that, but where it's like the sunlight is brighter and the room, the colors in the room, and everything is very crystal clear and your mind is clear. And I simply did a 180 at that point and decided I would not go to Korea. And although I still toyed with the idea of going on to medical school, I actually in the end didn't pursue that. So I stayed at Karma Choling. And that was in 1975. I gradually began cooking in the kitchen there and then co-ran the kitchen at Karma Choling until 1976, when after the regent's visit, his first visit as the Vajra regent in August of 1975 to Karma Choling.
A program called Feast of Devotion.
Oh, I didn't remember that. No.
So I was there.
Well, the Kalpa Court apparently was already in progress in Boulder. So plans were being made to, to make this Kalpa Court on Mapleton Avenue in Boulder, Colorado, the seat of Trungpa Rinpoche, the home. And the regent was looking around for his staff because he knew that eventually he would be moving in to the Mapleton Court with Trungpa Rinpoche, with his family. And so my now husband, Bob Vogler, he was serving the regent. The regent decided Bob would be just the person. And we were already a couple. We weren't married, but we were together. So in November, Bob was down in Boston training in service so that he could serve the first the Karmapa's first visit to North America in a more formal way with learning Tibetan service and all of that. And I was at Karma Choling when the regent phoned and said, "Would you and Bob like to come and be in my family's service and live at the Kalpa Court in Boulder?" And I asked him, "When would that be?" And he said, "In about 2 weeks." So Bob came back from Boston and we agreed to go and packed up. We each had one box of books and one suitcase. And Karma Choling and staff gave us a set of Zabutan and and Zafu as a goodbye present. And off we went to Boulder. So we only stayed in the regent and Leela Rich's house for probably a month.
So you were sort of household, running the household, sort of a...
So Bob was the regent's primary attendant, and I was asked if I would attend Lady Rich, Leela Rich, and help with the two children, Vajra and Anthony, who were quite young at that point. And so that was what I did. That's what Bob did and I did. And then the houses amalgamated. Now, so what was happening during that fall was the Shambhala teachings were manifesting, shall we say, in Trungpa Rinpoche.
The Ashe came down at the seminary of 1976.
Yeah. So, and there had been a number of students already trained in these seminaries, these three-month seminaries, right? And who were very devoted students to Trungpa Rinpoche. There were a number of them were carpenters, house painters, tons of students put together this Mapleton court, which was a lovely, lovely house on a big avenue and had a garden in the back. And Bob Howard designed gardens back there, there was a big wide entryway so you could formally enter in a sitting room and formal dining room, the sun porch off of that. We had a kitchen and a little sun porch off of that, which became the staff area. And at that point, the head of the staff was John Perks, who had been trained in England as a butler. So Trungpa Rinpoche was very excited by, you know, he had a British wife, he loved England, the whole formality of service, which teases out the mindfulness practice of the students, because there is a proper way to put the teacup on the table. And if you follow that from beginning to end, that becomes the object of your focus. So likewise, we did that with all kinds of service in the court. Uniforms were being developed at that point. The
costume were already really becoming more the costume.
They were. That was sort of 1977, 78. Mm-hmm. And Bob and I joined the Dorje Kosung in 1978. And so that was part of, because that sense of protecting the space in which these teachings could emerge, these precious teachings of Shambhala and Buddhism, there's a sense that it's easy to lose one's mind in those circumstances, let's put it that way. You're sitting there in a huge room listening to teachings from the teacher. You're trying to absorb that into your life, make a practice of it, or at the call of a court, you add the added layer of this English service on top of it and this formality. And it's easy to forget being present. So the Dorje Kosung helped to keep those teaching, keep that container of nowness, of presence.
I never really worked at the court, but what I remember a lot is how the entire spectacle was participatory. It wasn't like you were working for someone else and you were just working and they were living it. It's like the entire scenario was a kind of a participatory play, and everybody was part of it, and everything was based on some kind of precision and some kind of seeing your mind in all of its grand embarrassment and all of its grand devotion and all of its grand trying to hide, so on and so forth. So a day in the life of the Machen, what would it be like? Who was there? How did your day go by?
So as I get into that a little segue, if I might, one of the people that was instrumental in contributing to this court was Beverly Webster. And one of the, who was raised in another kind of formality, really not British, but North American. And actually, I have to say, in my own family, that is also how I was raised. So I'll back up a little even further. My parents, we set the table with knife, fork, and spoon every morning for breakfast. They had their coffee cup, the juice. I mean, it was, we sat down to dinner. There was a certain formality about our lives. And Beverly, as the, I'm assuming it was a very early on gift, if not sort of a housewarming gift, bought a set of Waterford crystal in the thistle pattern, which Trungpa Rinpoche just loved that. And I can't tell you, you know, it was like every meal, one of them was broken or chipped, right? So that you couldn't use it again. So here we were trying to slow down, but being very speedy. So that's my segue into, you know, it's that interesting juxtaposition between having, 25 people in various parts of the Kalpa court. So from the morning wake up, which would be, well, day in the life, actually, the children woke up first, probably.
And there were two sets of children, the regent's children and the Vidyadhara and Lady Diana's children.
There was Gesar. Tagi was not living there. So Gesar would have been about 8, I think. And Vajranathini somewhat younger. So they had nannies. And, I was helping with the regent's children to begin with. And Gesar had a nanny. The sawang was not there yet. So they would probably wake up first and then have their breakfast, which it would have been my responsibility to keep food stocked for this. And then perhaps Lily eating with the children. Perhaps Lady Diana eating with the children, although she was very active with her dressage world, so she was traveling a lot as well. And then probably next would be the regent awake, and then lastly in the day, later on in the day, would be Trungpa Rinpoche, could be early afternoon.
And throughout of this, so you have attendants, you have nannies, you have house cleaners, you probably have garden people, you have Dorje Kasam,
yeah,
cooks, mm-hmm, all the driver, whatever. It's a very large undertaking.
And there was some room in the basement, although Bob and I lived in the basement, as did John Perks. So, although there was some room in the basement, the kitchen tended to be kind of the staging point for the first floor and the second floor of the court. So it was always extremely crowded and chaotic.
So let's say that, what kinds of things did the Vidyadhara eat? Like, what, there you are, the Vidyadhara wakes up, and it's the beginning of a day that may begin, what, at 3 in the afternoon, maybe, who knows, unpredictable, then.
Unpredictable.
So let's say, if we were to pick a common day, what kinds of things would he eat? How would he approach it? Some of it alone, I'm sure, some of it in his bedroom, some of it public. How did it go?
Well, the very first thing that would happen would be the offerings to the shrine. So, that would happen always before eating.
And what kinds of things would he offer? Just tea and
tea.
Brakta? Just tea.
The tea offerings. So the tea offerings from the main shrine, the shrine that was in his sitting room, and the kitchen shrine. Okay. And all of that would be offered first, and we use gunpowder green tea for that.
And what would he eat for breakfast? Or that, sure, that would change. Or how did that evolve? Tell me the feeding patterns of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, if there's any such thing.
Well, he would eat eggs and French bread sometimes. He would eat something like breakfast or snack could be similar. Sometimes it could be something like a Noom Neboshi plum and blue cheese and French bread. Very occasionally, I would make sampa. It was very occasionally.
Tibetan.
Yeah, Tibetan barley. The most vivid memory of making that was while I was in labor with my first child. That was actually at the seminary in Lake Louise. He liked bandit soup, he was from Eastern Tibet. And bandit soup was so that the bandits could get away quickly at any point in time. So they would keep a haunch of meat hanging from their saddle, and they would make their tea, probably more like a Tibetan tea, whereas Trungpa Rinpoche would have a gunpowder green tea. And you shave the meat off into paper-thin slices and just pour hot tea over that. And it would essentially, the meat juices would just dissolve into the tea, and it would just barely cook the meat.
And there was a certain slurping sound that I remember every time he ate that. There's like, and he's sort of, upper lip would kind of bend over the bowl in a certain way that I've never seen anybody do. But so that's sort of probably a comfort food for the Vidyadhara. I remember he liked momos, or we did.
Momos were pretty much more party food, though. Mm-hmm. Celebration food, as opposed to every day. When I would go after breakfast, I would usually ask him, or he would call for me, to determine what the evening menu would be. Evening meaning?
Whatever.
Whenever. Usually after midnight. The last person and guests to eat in the household. Because there were usually about five different meals happening at dinner time, supper time as well. And there were volunteers. There were probably 100 different volunteers of various sorts in the Mapleton Court. And then each week, 100 different people, perhaps, at the Cascade. And maybe I'm not describing it quite right, because people chose their days and they actually became kind of friends with each other. So the Thursday Kusung, who would be the attendant for that day to Trungpa Rinpoche, often was close to the Thursday cook.
So it was like a crew almost.
Almost like a crew, yeah. So there were certain people that didn't do a weekly, and there were people that came in every day. Yeah.
Well, this is 24-hour service. I mean, this is... Never closes.
Yeah, pretty much. We did sleep.
Yeah, but there's always somebody somewhere else doing something.
Yes, that's right.
So basically, let's say, what would happen when you would run out of money? I mean, that's one of the things that was quite, sometimes I remember the entire board of directors and the staff of Karmazong at that time and Vajradhatu going on for months without a salary. So I imagine you run out of money to run the court also.
And it was a big operation, right? As you said, it was a big operation. So Trungpa has several ideas about that we never really accomplished that well, I have to say. But he wanted us to pool our resources, like cooperatively buying food. He wanted us to buy in bulk so that we actually had more buying power. And as we...
A whole community, you mean, or as a court?
Or as a court with perhaps other families so that we could buy wholesale,
yeah,
essentially. And we were buying at retail prices. Yeah.
For a lot of people.
For a lot of people, yes. So it was definitely challenging, and salaries were low to non-existent for those of us that did full-time work. And at one point, he asked my husband to become the bursar of the court because he thought that all the books would be kept well and precisely, which is very much Bob. But we still had people to dinner. So I don't know exactly how we managed it, actually.
The most beautifully arranged mashed potatoes.
We were frugal. I mean, we were frugal, and we didn't waste food, and staff would eat leftovers, and we would eat cheaply, those of us who lived there. So I still actually, it was kind of magic how it all happened. And I don't honestly know. There were people that fundraised and did a lot of hard work to support this. And I honestly don't know even how they did that.
What was it like when Sakya Mipan Rinpoche arrived?
Well, he arrived... I thought he was the age 14 when he arrived at the Mapleton House. And he was very thin and quiet and...
called Ursel at the time.
Called Ursel, yes. So Trungpa Rinpoche asked for certain people to come and start to work with him. And those were... people older than him, and he was going to school, and they were tutoring and helping him to get adjusted. And I do remember asking Trungpa Rinpoche, you know, did he have any instructions for us, for me to work with the Sawang, as he was called? And he said... you're right, he was Ursel
at that
point. Yeah. And he said, well, I think you should learn to cook and sew. And of course, I was quite startled by that. I thought it would be obviously something much more grand. And it was, and the point that Trungpa Rinpoche made was that he would have to understand how to guide or command others. And therefore, he had to understand the workings. If you're going to ask someone to cook for you, you have to understand what it takes to cook.
Speaking of, this reminds me of the 1973 seminary, which is the only time I had the pleasure of eating a meal cooked by Trungpa Rinpoche. He made pink lemonade and sardine soup. To be had with very cheap Gallo wine. And I'm sure that he had much more interesting recipes besides that.
I bet that one, though, fit within the budget.
Oh, Lord.
So, you know, one of the things he was very fond of cooking, that we cooked together, actually, I cooked under his guidance, was congee. And he was very fond of making that for his board of directors.
And describe that, congee, for those who don't know what it is.
So this form of congee, you take ground beef, and with your bare hands, you kind of knead it into water. And then as you heat up the water, the juices of the beef come out into and make a broth, a nice broth. And then you put rice into that and cook that until it's very...
mushy?
Yeah, sort of like oatmeal, I guess, you know, the thick porridge. And then he liked to have cloudier fungus in that, which is a little crunchy.
What fungus?
Cloudier fungus. That's a Chinese, it's used in Chinese cooking. And, oh gosh, we put all kinds of things in at various times. Sometimes we'd use fermented bean curd in it, also used in Chinese cooking. So when the vegetarian are cooked, at least when I cooked with him, I found that there were these elements of taste and smell. There was an earthy taste. He likes cilantro or scallion would be in that. He liked salty. So the fermented bean curd, soy sauce would go on, so on. He liked meat, you know, that kind of earthiness of meat. And of course, that's an interesting discussion because most people assume that Buddhists are vegetarians, right?
But then Tibetans would have died.
Exactly. They would never have survived. And so their tradition, which, you know, perhaps we follow or not follow here, but they would never have survived.
And he loved hot food.
And something spicy. That's right.
And when you describe this entire play, for lack of a word, participatory event, there was also great simplicity. And the Vidyadhar was probably the reference point for that simplicity, because we've talked about that sometimes.
So if you can imagine, you know, what's left of the Waterford crystal, and beautiful china, and polished silver, and a white tablecloth, and serving staff in uniform who are his students, and then a very repetitive diet that he liked at these dinner parties. So week to week, you might see boiled tripe, noodles and cauliflower, roast beef, Yorkshire pudding, Brussels sprouts, be another meal. Boiled lamb chops that were boiled in marmite and water, and maybe potatoes with that. He liked spaghetti bolognese, but he didn't like it with garlic in it. Really didn't like garlic and didn't like onions very much. That, I think, is also
monastic.
Yeah, more a monastic. But this would be week after week. So if you can imagine the volunteers also that, you know, that I worked with, volunteer cooks that came in. So sometimes I would cook, sometimes volunteers, you know, they had their regular nights that they would come in. I mean, one of them was Tobias Walsh, who was a chef at the Waldorf Astoria. And he would come in, and almost every Thursday, Trungpa Rinpoche would like roast leg of lamb. And goodness knows what Tobias could cook. He and I once cooked for the, this would be in the Cascade Court, for the Chinese ambassador who came to visit. And we...
To the United States, the Chinese ambassador to
the United States came to visit Trungpa Rinpoche at the Kalpa Court. The Cascade Court. On
Very
11th.
Significant considering the relations between Tibet and China at that time.
Right. So that would have been the early 80s then. And, you know, Tobias took the lead on that, and the canapes looked like something you would have had at the Waldorf Astoria. Like, and the service was beautiful. You know, John Perks and my husband, who was well-trained in service, you know, they had their volunteers. And what I remember was that the Chinese ambassador said, his comment, this is what Trungpa Rinpoche told us afterwards, that he was surprised at how civilized we were.
Did Trungpa Rinpoche speak Chinese?
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
No.
I don't think so.
So then, you know, we had Jose Alvarez on Fridays, and he was Portuguese. And he always wanted, you know, he would always ask, could he, you know, did Tom Bermuche want this Portuguese food that he could make
Canto
so
verde,
beautiful?
This green soup.
But basically, he did boiled lamb chops with Marmite on Friday nights. And, so there was this, simplicity that Tom Bermuche didn't require
endless
day to day. Yes. There was a certain simplicity to that. And mind you, the Regent was having much more, you know, there were the Japanese
Italian meals
and the Italian. Actually, his Italian, he liked kind of simple Italian meals, but then he liked the anime. And, you know, Lady Diana coming back from Vienna when she had studied dressage and wanting some more Viennese type
food.
Whatever. So there was a lot happening there. And, but there was this thread of kind of simplicity and not all dressed up. But then when celebrations happened, that's when we became more Ratna.
Celebrations like?
Shambhala Day, for example, which were prepared, you know, weeks in advance.
Very Tibetan, right? I mean, the Tibetans do the same thing, right? And the Bhutanese, they
do
spend weeks getting ready. And what kinds of food did you have for Shambhala Day? And it started early in the morning, too.
So Trumpermche would wake up usually about 4:30 in the morning which is very early for him, on Shambhala Day. It's like greeting the new year with such great excitement. And then he would go to Karmatsang and give the public address to the community, and then come back for breakfast. And I often didn't cook those. It was almost
your one day off a year?
Kind of thing. Well, no, there were more than that, because he traveled, Trungpa Rinpoche traveled and taught, and I didn't always go with him.
Did you train the cooks, though? Did you have like a cadre of people who knew what they were doing all around?
Yeah, I created a manual, actually. So there was a written manual that had kind of service and food and that kind of thing in it. Yeah. So it wasn't as easy, you know. There was no FaceTime.
Internet.
You know, everything was much more laborious. And if you can imagine all these people, cooking for all these people all the time. Because, you know, Lila would sometimes have a few guests, and the Regent might have four or five guests. Rumichi later on, maybe eight of them for dinner or so. So it was busy. So, for example, Ken Green, who was on the board of directors at that point, some other people, they cooked Indian breakfasts. That happened a few times on Shambhala Day mornings. And I remember when Ken ordered banana leaves so that those became the plates. We sat at low tables. So at that point, then I was a guest at that. So often on Shambhala Day, I would become a guest at the dinner. And the whole day was filled. I mean, it wasn't just Ratna in terms of food. It was Ratna in terms of events as well. Because there were two meals of about 44, 45 people. So then we had Chinese. So at that point, Max King would come in and cook. Sometimes we had kind of shabu shabu.
Shabu shabu is in some sort of
hot pots.
Hot pots.
Hot pots, right? So you start with water or broth, and you're putting thin slices of meat and cellophane noodles and vegetables.
So very celebratory types of meals.
Or momos, right?
And then at one point, you were one time reminiscing about the welcoming of Mrs. Pybus, Lady Diana's mother, to the Kalapa court, and what that was like.
Yeah, so she really visited the Mapleton court for the first time in the summer, one summer. And relations had been a bit strained. Just thinking of my own family, my parents seeing their sort of, well, you know, their daughter had gone to university and studied the sciences.
A doctor to be.
Yeah, all of a sudden leaving to live in the household of a Tibetan teacher. I can well imagine that Mrs. Pybus had difficulty.
Well, you didn't marry him when you were 16.
No.
So that would have created a little further tension.
Yeah. So for a lot of reasons, Mrs. Pybus, you know,
objected to the marriage.
Right.
Shall we
so
say?
And Trungpa Rinpoche, on a much smaller scale, also created events for my own parents, actually, a couple times throughout. But this particular summer afternoon, Mrs. Pybus came to visit from England to Boulder. And the board of directors and the kind of various leadership of the community were invited. And I believe it was a Sunday afternoon. And so, you know, there was tea. We made tea and cakes and little sandwiches and all of that.
But he Fortnum and Mason, probably.
But he had wanted some alcohol also to be served.
And refreshments.
For refreshments. And I believe the stores weren't open, so there was no way. So one of these, one of our serving staff was also a chemist. And so he had the bright idea to get a small quantity of pure ethanol that we could spike the punch with to make it a bit more lively.
So was Lady Diana...
I believe it was a pink punch.
A pink punch. So was Lady Pybus won over by the elegance of the... It was like a Queen's Garden party, probably.
Yeah, exactly. And it was... I think she was pleasantly surprised, and it was the beginning of melting and really coming much closer and
the winning
much
over
more
of
affectionate.
The mother-in-law.
Of the mother-in-law, that's right. And really, I remember in the Cascade Court, when my parents came to visit, Trungpa Rinpoche invited them to tea, and we sat in the drawing room together, my parents and Bob and I, with Trungpa Rinpoche, and he talked to them and really kind of wooed them. Later on, my mother read Path of the Warrior, and she ended up teaching a couple of weekends at Karma Choling with Judy Leaf on death and dying, because that's what she was well known for in the States, and there teaching came together. So there, you know, and she thought that was just a wonderful book. She found it very difficult to meditate, mind you. But she would go to the New Haven Shambhala Center. She became friends in particular with two members there, and one that she worked hospice with and one that she was in the Yale Nursing School, of which my mother had been dean of, and some great friendships and understanding about Buddhism. So, you know, the reason I'm telling you this story is because with this great purpose, kindness, humor. I just saw this day in and day out. Trungpa Rinpoche would find these opportunities to open vistas for people.
And invite your entire life. Well, if you were his students, he would invite your life into the world. It wasn't an exclusion.
We weren't removed, no. Not by any means, yeah.
He always asked how my parents were.
Yeah.
always, invariably. Mm-hmm. And sent his regards. My mother called me Rinpochita or Kasunga. Kasunga!
So in 1976, we, along with these multitudes of students who helped create the court, actually put it together. And then it was in full service at the beginning of 1977. February 2nd, 1977, Bob and I were wedded by, officiated by Trungpa Rinpoche in the Kalpa court. So the dining room table was pushed to the sunroom, a shrine was put in there, and we fit 35 people. And Bob's mother came, and his sister, and my parents, and my brother, and then another about 30, and the Regent and Lady Rich were there, and about 30 other Trungpa Rinpoche students. If you can visualize the serving staff, the women in black blouses, long black skirts, and white aprons, sort of almost like penguins because
the
they
penguin
stuck
outfits,
out.
Yeah.
Right. Sort of a almost oriental or Japanese look, samurai look to that, right? To that, but black and white. And they were serving, and we couldn't, it was so crowded, we couldn't even get up to put the offerings on the shrine. We just handed them to the shrine. And Trungpa Rinpoche, the wedding was 2 hours late because he decided that he wanted to read the homage.
The Shambhala
homage. The Shambhala homage. And it hadn't been typed yet. So Connie Berman, who seems to have woven in and out of our lives, who was secretary that day, she went over to the Triple Gem offices, typed it up, and came back. But all of that, finding the key and opening it up, and took a couple of hours. And then we had a traditional Buddhist wedding, and then there was a bit of reception as they set up for the meal. And Trungpa Rinpoche said this, oh, actually it was at the ceremony, he said, this is our first family wedding. So it was really that, it was the first wedding. It may have been the only wedding in the Mapleton court, actually. And, you know, that was how he, again, how he brought my parents and Bob's mother into that Shambhala world. And then we had momos and English fruitcake. So later on that year, Rinpoche went on retreat to Charlemont, and the Shambhala teachings were expanded.
Yeah, they were working on it with John Perks and creating many of the forms we
yes.
have today.
And Max King at that point was his cook. And then something changed when they all arrived back in Boulder. And I had been cooking for the Regent's family, so I just cooked for Trungpa Rinpoche and, you know, cooked kind of a pot-roasted type meat. And it was around Passover time. And my heritage is Jewish, and so I put matzah out, and Rinpoche kept asking for more of that Jewish bread. And then not too long after that, you know, within days, he asked if I would be his cook.
After he went to his Seder.
After he went to his Seder.
Right? He just wanted you to be...
To keep cooking.
To keep cooking for him. So you were also privy to his illness towards the end of his life. I mean, you came to Nova Scotia, and you probably sort of foresaw or were part of kind of almost like his getting extinguished or falling ill, which I'm sure changed the character of the court.
Oh, yes, considerably. It was, he was determined to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish, and he was ill from 83.
And what was that? What do you think he wanted to accomplish?
He wanted to establish and ensure that the Shambhala teachings and Buddhism would be well rooted in the West. And in particular, he felt that Nova Scotia would be receptive to these teachings. And in a world that was increasingly violent, aggressive, decadent, that he needed to find a place that things would continue. So he made every effort, despite his illness, to do that. And I know it was not easy for him.
Did he spend a lot of time on the...
He also didn't complain.
He didn't complain, it's true.
He didn't complain.
He did the Karmapa. When Trungpa Rinpoche was here in Nova Scotia and very ill, was he on a IV or what did he eat when he was... He was quite ill for a long time, I mean...
So... I arrived here. Well, I came right after his first the heart attack, and then Bob and I actually moved here in December of 86, and actually Trungpa Rinpoche had at the end of that seminary at
SMC.
Was it RMDC, I guess, then?
Yeah. Yeah, Rocky Mountain Shambhala Center, 1986.
Yes.
When
yes.
He left.
And then I packed up, came back, and the Lama and Mitchell Levy said, Trungpa Rinpoche wants you and the whole family to come to Nova Scotia and live at the court there. And there were five of us by then, by the way. And
your three children.
Our three children, yeah. And could we leave in 3 days? So that was September of 86. And by December, so I was there within days of his heart attack. So he was still in the hospital. And then he made it home when we arrived in December of 86, fully landed. It was, for some odd reason, totally easy for us, our whole family, to move to Nova Scotia. So we did, sold our house in Boulder, did all of that in 3 months and moved here. And pretty much he was eating a really simplified diet. So it was kind of, I think it was something that the Laman had kind of figured out during those couple of months. And
Lama
so that was
his
more
doctor,
his doctor, right? Yeah. So Weetabix, which he had always been fond of, Weetabix, and a little bit of yogurt and some blueberries and not much, or blueberry yogurt. So not much really more than that, a little broth. And it wasn't... he didn't need IVs at that point, but later on, yeah.
So I imagine the environment around the court was quiet and contemplative. And
mm-hmm. And very few people. And that had actually already happened, like 86. At seminary, we used to also use that as a training ground for students from all over the world who were coming to study these Buddhist teachings. They would come and serve in Rinpoche's household at seminary and learn this formal service and take that back into their own homes and so on. But in 86, he kind of put his foot down, and there were only about 10 of us that he wanted around him at all, period.
Yeah,
it was already...
waning and quite ill, actually.
He was quite ill.
Yeah. Seminary talks were very short. I was supposed to be his secretary at that seminary. I couldn't make it, and it's probably one of the few things I regret in my life. But just to close the interview, I find it very interesting, just listening to you speak about your new profession as a chronic pain nurse, because it's almost as we all check out slowly, you and all our friends of a certain age, you've become kind of the machin of the cocktails, the pain cocktails, which will probably become what we collectively will have with each other. Can you talk a little bit about your attraction to that career and how do you approach it and so on?
I would say that the training I received from Trungpa Rinpoche all those years, it's thoroughly soaked in me. And so that's just integrally joined with my nursing practice at this point. So people come with these, you know, terrible pain conditions that have really interrupted their lives. And they, you know, the first thing is some kind of hospitality. And that helps them to settle and focus on, I work obviously in conjunction with physicians, but it's helping them focus and articulate their issues. But to do that, there has to be some kind of hospitality. So it's greeting each other properly, right from the waiting area. There's some humor involved, if the person's receptive, obviously. But that kind of melts again. I mean, these are all the things that he utilized, Trungpa Rinpoche utilized for us as students, right? I mean, I can see you nodding your head. It's very familiar to you. So it's no different. I don't find it any different. I also have to hold boundaries. My training is Dorje Kassang. So people who abuse their medications, for example, there has to be some, you know, I'm not the prescriber, mind you, but I am part of that process.
You're like their MI, really, their meditation instructor in some way in terms of the psychological and physical experience of their pain and their interaction with the medication and whatever else you're doing, right?
Well, yeah, the nursing staff provides some continuity there. Mm-hmm. The physicians have, you know, their directed problem-solving things that they do, but the nurses provide a background of support as well. And, you know, it's really not much different than how we were trained. Obviously, all the science and things are on top of that, but yeah.
Well, Sherry, I want to thank you for granting this interview and for giving our listeners a window into that magnificent world that Trungpa Rinpoche created as a training ground for all of us, and that Sakyong Mipham has continued also as a training ground. And hopefully we can find many ways, even in our careers, to bring that to the fore, as you're doing with your chronic pain management nurse. And may I have, as I told you earlier on today, may you stay alive to keep many of us on the spot as we check out of here. Thank you once again.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about subjects that I love.